It's Sunday morning, time for the great outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Your host, Charlie Potter, here on WGN Radio. I hope you all had a wonderful Thanksgiving, and this being the Sunday after Thanksgiving, that you still are having a great Thanksgiving weekend with friends and family. And today I'm going to cover a few things that I think both not only we have to be thankful for, but also some things that have developed in the past few days, this past week on the conservation front. And most importantly on that, Secretary of Agriculture has been nominated, Brooke Rollins from Texas. She becomes the second lady to become female to become the Secretary of Agriculture, Ann Benneman, under President Bush. George W. Bush was the first. So she comes from a background which, for people in the Corn Belt, the Midwest, and maybe other parts of the country, a little bit of a head scratcher. She is from Texas. The question is, how will Brooke Rollins treat conservation? She does not come from the corn and soybean sort of background. She comes from a state big in, once big in rice, not anymore, and big in cotton. But she probably brings an ideology that will be one that changes how the Department of Agriculture looks at some of its programs, and particularly the conservation titles of the Farm Bill. And without getting terribly technical on this Sunday after Thanksgiving, as we're all still digesting lots of food and having fun with our family, I will offer this thought. The conservation provisions of the Farm Bill are the most important elements to clean water, clean air, and soil erosion, reducing soil erosion in America. We think of the Department of Interior as being the great watchguard or safeguard, if you will, for our public lands and for fish and wildlife. Actually, it's not. The Department of Agriculture is where the conservation provisions take place and where the impact on fish and wildlife across the country is greatest. And I've said for a long time, if we really want to have incredibly abundant wildlife and fisheries populations, we just give it to the Department of Agriculture to deliver, because 95% of the game and fish raised in America are produced on private lands, particularly game, and that includes birds. The private landowner controls the future of conservation in America, and it's the private landowner that works with the Department of Agriculture on an ongoing basis. Think of all the farms across the Midwest, all across the country. Every single farmer operating one of those properties is working with the Department of Agriculture. And those of you in agriculture listening this morning are nodding your heads. You may not like working with the Department of Agriculture, or you may like it very much, but you're definitely working with them. And the Natural Resource Conservation Service has long been the USDA's conservation arm. So with the appointment of Secretary Rollins, should be she being confirmed, the question will be, what does conservation spending and provisions look like? The Conservation Reserve Program once had over 42 million acres of conservation reserve lands set aside for the betterment of water quality and soil erosion, which was a huge benefit to wildlife as well. We're now down way below that. We're in the mid-20s and sinking. The re-enrollment is not taking place at anywhere near the levels that it had previously. So will there be funds to continue the most successful conservation element of the Farm Bill ever designed? And that started in 1985 with the Conservation Reserve Program. The entitlements of the Department of Agriculture, food stamps, SNAP payments, etc., are the largest part of their budget. However, the conservation title is for those of us who love the outdoors, the single most important part. I don't know her background in conservation, but I would think that she and the governor of North Dakota, who is going to be the incoming Secretary of Interior, if confirmed, they will be working together on the conservation provisions, and that offers an interesting look. The governor of North Dakota comes from a big ag state at the north end, if you will, of the flyway, and she comes from a big ag state at the south end of the flyway. Their conservation needs are very different between the two of them. But as a country, I think we should have a discussion as to, once again, what do we expect private landowners to do for the public good? And what I mean by that is we pass all kinds of regulations that limit what a private landowner can and can't do on their property without compensation. And yet the private landowner is the one who raises most of America's wildlife, so and contributes directly to most of the health of our fisheries. So if we want to have really abundant bird populations and really healthy wildlife populations, we need to work with the American farmer to ensure that they can productively do that. It does not work to tell a landowner, you can't do this, you can't plow this close to a road, you can't plow this close to a river, when in fact that enables the landowner to pay their bills. If we expect landowners to do good things for society, in other words, have setbacks from rivers, reduce soil erosion, leave grass strips, leave filter strips, provide areas for wildlife, which we all value as a society, then the landowner has to be compensated for that. And I think what I'm hearing in the early, very early stages is that we have not only a Secretary of the Interior nominee, but also a Secretary of the Agriculture nominee, who both believe that you have to empower landowners to do things on their land for the good of society if you expect them to do those good things. Because after all, they too are running a business, and every acre that they leave that could be planted to some productive crop that's left for wildlife is a cost to them. And the number of landowners who today can afford to do that is increasingly shrinking. And it's also shrinking because farms have become so very large that many people don't live on the land, and many, many farms across America are leased out to farmers. The owners of that property live in cities elsewhere or distant from the property, and they're not there to make sure that their favorite little slough in the back 40, which of course now it's the back probably 4,000, is being protected, or that that little bit of cover along the edge of a stream is being left. They're not there, and the individual who's running the land has huge equipment, and these little places are, frankly, of real inconvenience. And today's equipment can go right through them, tear them up, and plant them to productive cropland. So we have a difference today than we did in the 1960s when we had the Soil Bank program, when lots of landowners lived on the land. And the Soil Bank program, which was extremely successful, came out of the dirty 30s, the Great Drought, and the great huge, when we had these enormous dust storms, came with people still living on the land. So they knew where that hedgerow should go. They knew where they wanted to have filter strips. Now we don't live so much on the land, and that local knowledge or that local caring about keeping that area for a bunch of pheasants or turkeys or ducks or whatever it might have been, that's going away as big ag necessarily is run by big equipment, and lots of absentee landowners own the land, and they don't know what the tenant may be doing, and the tenant's not doing anything nefarious. They're just trying to make the best living they can. Hopefully, with the nomination of Secretary Rollins, and along with the nomination of the governor of North Dakota to be Secretary of Interior, we actually have now a confluence of individuals who understand these issues. And with the coming conservation titles of the Farm Bill, are going to look for ways to incentivize productive use of our lands for both fish and wildlife, soil erosion, water quality, in addition to productive use of our lands to provide food and fiber and energy to our country. We will see what happens, but that is, in fact, where we are right now. And I'm very hopeful, actually. A lot of people in the conservation world are not so optimistic. I am optimistic that Brooke Rollins from Texas will become a change agent for agriculture, bringing about certainly badly needed efficiencies. That has been one of her hallmarks all of her career, but also have an open mind as to how we create new ways to have more people succeed on the farm. And she does come to agriculture with a very strong interest in rural economies. And goodness knows our rural economies, not only in Illinois, but across the country, need real help. So the Department of Agriculture can provide that in many ways, and I think one of them is going to be true innovation. I think we're going to see some very, very innovative thoughts coming out of the Department of Agriculture. When I come back, I'm going to talk about deer on the roads, a subject right now at this time of the year, it's very hard to avoid. And then I'm going to end with what we can be thankful for. We sure have a lot on this Thanksgiving weekend. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN. And first, a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter here on WGN Radio on this Thanksgiving weekend. And one of the things that's happening at this time of the year is deer on the roads. Why are there so many now? And why are deer car collisions continuously increasing? Let me just run some numbers for you. There are 2.1 million. That is correct. Over 2 million vehicle car collisions each year. 59,000 people, it's estimated, annually are hurt by hitting a deer, and around 450 people are killed annually. So think about those numbers. 2 million cars hit deers or vehicles hit deer. 59,000 people last year were hurt, and 440 people were killed. There's about $10 billion in economic losses, and it's increasing every year, from deer automotive accidents. The majority of the accidents happen right where we are here in the Midwest. So all of you listening across the heartland, we are the place where the majority of the accidents happen. And why are they happening so much this time of the year? Because it's the mating season. The buck deer are in rut, the does are moving, and deer leave a lot of their sort of, if you will, sedentary habits during the mating season, and they travel great distances. They're on the move. Big buck deer or even small bucks are chasing does, and in fact, one of the things that happens is a big buck chases a small buck out of his territory, and that small buck has to go find the new territory, crosses roads. So the fall is the single worst time for animal collisions with automobiles. And in the West, it's much worse than deer. It's big things called antelope and moose. Big things called elk and moose. And of course, there are antelope getting hit too. But you hit an elk or a moose with your car, and you have a very, very, very severe problem. What absolutely everybody says is never swerve to avoid an animal. Hit it head on. That may seem counterintuitive, but your car, your vehicle, your truck is set up to hit something head on, not on the side. If you swerve, the chances are you can go off the road, hit a telephone pole, or worse, swerve into another lane of oncoming traffic. You have to hit an animal head on. And as hard as that seems, that is the only way. If you have a deer, or God forbid you have an elk or a moose standing in front of you, you got to hit them head on. It's the only way to do it to avoid even further injury. But it is definitely rising, incidents with cars. Of course, there are more people driving, but there are also more fragmented habitats. And one of the reasons that we have such high deer car auto collisions is because of our fragmented habitats. Roads have cut through extended areas of habitat. You've got big farms that have maybe a patch of woods over here and 2 miles away, there's another farm with a patch of woods or a patch of cover. The deer are traveling between those roads in between. Big blocks of habitat tend to minimize the number of animals that are hit on the road. fragmented habitats, suburbia. Think about suburbia and around the Chicago area or Indianapolis or Minneapolis or Milwaukee, wherever you might be listening. All the fragmented habitats, subdivisions, then a forest preserve or a park. Deer are moving through all these, but it is unbelievable to think that there are over 2 million cars and trucks a year hitting deer alone. It's not going to go away. It's a huge expense, not only in economic terms, but ultimately in the worst terms. It costs lives. So be careful on the roads in the fall, especially, and deer are most active at dawn and at dusk. That's when they're most likely to move. But during the fall, during rut, which is right now, they are likely to be moving all the time. So in the couple minutes left, I want to transfer from that to what do we have to be thankful for? We have a lot to be thankful for on this Thanksgiving weekend. And the first is that we can go hunting at all. Lots of countries have banned hunting. Unfortunately, Australia, which we think of in many ways as a country much like us, they are having huge issues now with anti-hunters trying to close hunting seasons in Australia, not based on any science, but based on emotion. The kangaroo is very plentiful in Australia. It's harvested for its skins and its meat, and yet the anti-hunters in Australia don't want the kangaroos to be harvested and be able to ship around the world. So they're working on boycotts, trying to stop and restrictions, trying to stop that. Waterfowl hunting in Australia has never had the deeply ingrained traditions it does here in North America, but certainly it's been a long time tradition since settlement. And now waterfowl, it's common for waterfowl hunting in Australia to be disrupted by protesters and people. And I saw this week a picture of a hunter with decoys in front of him, and standing in the water in the decoys are 10 people dressed in blaze orange with nets and kazoos and all kinds of things. In the United States, almost every state has an anti-hunter harassment law, which says that you cannot interfere with a lawfully executed hunt. And yet you have efforts such as just took place, but which was defeated in Colorado, to try to outlaw the hunting or trapping of mountain lions and bobcats. And I mentioned last week on the show, it's now believed one of the major reasons that sage grouse populations are plummeting is because of bobcats. So if we stop hunting of bobcats, what do we think is going to happen to our bird populations? What do we think is going to happen to sage grouse? So that is one of the things I think we're really thankful for. And 22 states now have constitutional amendments to protect the right of hunting enshrined in their state constitution. Don't look at Illinois. We're not one of them. In 1777, Vermont was the first state to enshrine in their constitution the right to hunt. Here we are over 200 years later. Illinois is still not there, but some of our neighbors are. Indiana does, Minnesota does, Wisconsin. All three of those states enshrine the right to hunt. And lastly, we should be thankful that we have great science in fisheries, great science in wildlife management, because that drives good management. And lastly, I guess, on top of that, we have opportunity. We're not England, where there's almost no public space to go hunting. We're not Europe. Fortunately, we are incredibly lucky to have lots of public areas to hunt and fish. The further west you go, the more you have. But even in a heavily privatized state like Illinois, we still have opportunities for those who may not know a landowner to let them on. We have a lot to be thankful for in the outdoors and as Americans on this Thanksgiving weekend. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back next Sunday morning with much more on the great outdoors. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.